Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
It's Dr. Raj Balkaran. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Pankaj Jain from the University of North Texas on his new book, Dharma in America. Hello, Pankaj. How are you doing?
Hello, Raj. It's good to hear your voice and good to connect finally.
Yes, it's good to connect. These interviews have been done remotely on Skype or Zoom for as long as I've been doing them. So thankfully, they're immune to the effects of COVID-19.
Yeah, so
we're good to go. Mm-hmm. So Dharma in America, what is the main objective of your book?
Idea came to me about three, four years back when I was reading I came across a book called Muslims and Making of America by Professor Amir Hossain at LMU Los Angeles. And he begins the book very provocatively, that saying that there was never an America without Muslims. That was a really striking line to begin a book. And I do not imagine that America always had Muslims since its inception. That was very interesting. And then as I finished reading that book, I thought of writing a similar book and maybe explore how Hindus or Indians in general, from people from India, how, if any, have been their contributions in so-called making of America. So when I began thinking, I thought that this timeline should begin with not just United States of America, but also with Caribbean countries, Suriname, Trinidad, and other Central American countries where Indians arrived, as you know, as indentured laborers more than 150 years ago. So that's how I began envisioning this book. And so my humble attempt is to, I guess, remind some of the readers that that even Hindus have been here for a quite long time, not just in last 20, 30 years, but people have been coming to this part of the world for more than almost like two centuries now. Yeah, that's where I am. Yeah.
So your book essentially establishes the overall sweeping contribution of individuals from South Asian descent. Yeah. Really across continental America, the United States of America, Canada, where I live and work currently, the West Indies off of the coast of South America. So really, you know, there is this broader sweep that you are discussing. And yet there's a very specific focus towards America, as in the United States of America, would you say?
So it's a book that takes a historical approach, but it also takes kind of an anthropological approach, and I especially look at the areas where Indians or Hindus in general, or Indian Americans in general, have contributed, but they have not been noticed in academic books, such as there are many diaspora books where Hindu temples, Hindu gurus, meditation movements are celebrated, are mentioned, described, researched. But I didn't come across a diaspora studies book where similar contributions in food industry, for example, healthcare industries, classical music, or even contributions or lives of Jains or Jain temples across North America. I did not come across a book so far where Jains have been described in detail, how Jains arrived here and how they have continued to thrive in this part of the world. And then civic engagements. So, for example, Indian Americans and how those how they are trying to... So when we think of Indian American and politics or civic engagement, we probably think of Nikki Haley as the ex-governor of South Carolina, or Bobby Jindal as ex-governor of Louisiana. But Indian Americans are also trying to enter, you know, school politics or city council politics. So based on my own autoethnography, if you could call it, I share some of my own experiences in school, public school system here in Dallas area. So the book is trying to weave a pattern of less commonly areas where Indian Americans have been working or trying to contribute in their own humble ways. Not so often.
Well, there's a number of there's a number of threads in your book, and I think we should touch on them individually. For example, we'll touch on the Indian contribution towards medicine as well as towards music, and we'll also, of course, touch on your own personal experiences with the system in the States. Maybe a good idea might be to go chapter by chapter. So in the first chapter, you basically explain how you sort of the genesis of this book in terms of drawing on Amir Hussein's insightful and provocative statement about Muslims being foundational to America. I actually had the good fortune of working with him when he was the editor of the Jar of the Journal.
Oh, yes.
The American Academy of Religion, in 2012, I was lucky enough to have something published there in my grad school days. So, so he's no slouch, right? So beyond chapter one, where you talk about the genesis, let's focus on chapter two then. It's along the lines of before coolies. What do you talk about in chapter two?
So chapter two is where it all begins, right? The indentured laborers start coming in thanks to the British Raj, who brought these people all the way from, mostly from North India, but also some parts of South India, UP, Bihar, and also Andhra and Tamil Nadu. And tracing some history from Columbus, how he was lured by India, but he came to West Indies and Bahari, West Indies parts of the islands of West Indies or Caribbean countries. And then so during that research, I was really struck how the first Hindu temple was built in that part of Western Hemisphere, not in North America, not in...
Just a quick moment to contextualize for our audience. You are referring... to the Caribbean, to what's called the West Indies. Yes? This is just to give them a sense of where you're talking about in America now.
Yeah, I think Bahamas and Trinidad and Suriname and all of those countries are, I think, included in when we say Caribbean countries, right? Jamaica and Guyana and all that. Yeah.
Sure. And please go on. So regarding migration and indentured laborship in that part of the world, please continue.
So really, I was fascinated as I kept discovering. It was a relatively new area of my research. My earlier books have been on environmental studies, but this was really interesting to find out and to share with readers that that Suriname was once ruled by the Netherlands, and as it gained its independence, Hindus from Suriname migrated to the Netherlands. And to the best of my knowledge that I figured out, I think they some of them are still in the Netherlands, but and yet not fully integrated. And they, you know, thousands of those Hindus from Suriname, they are treated like a minority or, you know, separate ghetto within the Netherlands. That was really interesting. In Trinidad, they have been more successful within Trinidad, Trinidad itself, in you know, making really huge contributions. For example, in Diwali being the largest or most important festival of Hindus across the world, Trinidad probably is the one of the first countries in this part of the world, in Western Hemisphere, where Diwali is now a national holiday. I was really that was a very interesting to find out, and that became an impetus for us here in Texas, Dallas area, to request for a similar holiday in local schools in Dallas area, where now 60% of all students in my own school district, where my kids go to schools, 60% of those have Hindu or Indian or South Asian heritage. So researching with about Trinidad gave us an idea to request for a similar holiday in Dallas. Of course, we didn't succeed based on many arguments that it's a separation of church and state thing and so on. But then we ask, why is Christmas a national holiday? And why is Easter, Good Friday, a state holiday, unofficially, but it is a state holiday. All schools are closed in Texas. But when we ask for Diwali, even with 60% Hindus in schools, and in California, there are many school systems where 75% of kids are of that heritage, and yet there is no Diwali holiday. Anyway, so I just, those all ideas are so intermeshed and intertwined that researching and activism and teaching and all of those things are kind of became intertwined more and more. So going back to Trinidad, so Trinidad is, I think, where Hindus have been, you know, a bit more assertive in making sure that they are treated equally with their other counterparts. Suriname also was interesting in other ways. When I learned that by this migration of Hindus from North India to Suriname, a new dialect of Hindi has developed in Suriname, which is called as Sarnami. I guess Suriname and Sarnami. So that's a very interesting dialect, and I would love to personally visit once to that part of the world and see how, you know, how it is different from Hindi. I'm not yet sure. So Suriname, Trinidad, similarly Jamaica, and you know, so these are parts. Some of these countries are part of South America, not just North or Central America, but actual South America, where there are Hindus living for more than a century, almost 150 years. So that's not, I think, those who are in diaspora studies, I think, I'm sure they're well-versed with these facts. But some of us who are kind of new to diaspora studies, at least I was before I started writing that chapter, it was really interesting to discover all those all that information. I think you have some connection also that with that part of the world. I'm not yet sure, maybe you can share later, but I discovered that many of those Hindus or of that heritage people from these countries also migrated, not just to the Netherlands, as I alluded earlier, but they, of course, have also been migrating to Canada and United States, so North America. And those are what are the issues of Hindus moving from Caribbean countries to North America, and how they have kind of maintained a very interesting dynamic with larger Indian American population. I know that, for example, an organization called Hindu American Foundation has tried its best to integrate Hindus from Caribbean countries to be part of the global Hindu diaspora. But in many instances, for example, in Dallas, where I live for last a decade now, almost 10 years now, I was fascinated to find out that Hindus from Caribbean countries that have migrated in Dallas have kept their own separate temple, their own separate organization, group, and they may not necessarily completely intermingle with Hindus that are coming from India. Very interesting. And even the Indian government, I guess, very surprisingly, would gladly give the status of OCI, Overseas Citizenship of India, gladly give to people of Indian origin who are in North America. But people in Suriname and Trinidad, I think, are still waiting to get that kind of status, which gives lifelong visa to go back to India. That's such a, I think, as I interviewed some of the Hindus from Trinidad in Dallas, they are still waiting to get the same privilege to be able to get that freedom to go back to India, to visit India without visa for lifelong, that lifelong freedom that we get with the OCI status. So interesting comparative features as if we compare Hindus with Hindus of Caribbean countries with Hindus of North America. So those were some of the issues. And then the earliest temple that was built was, I think, Jamaica or Guyana, British Guyana, I think, where more than 100 years ago, people have found a Hindu temple. So that was interesting. What else can I highlight in this chapter?
There are a number of fascinating issues that come up in this chapter, because in many ways, there are phenomena that directly relates or pertains to individuals of South Asian descent who are engaged in Hindu practice, living on this broad continent. So there is this general sweeping parallel, and yet there's something very different as well in terms of a swath of citizens coming across 150 years ago, mostly through indentured labor contracts, and then having developed a nation that is relatively pluralistic, wherein people in the villages would partake in Christmas, Eid, and Diwali in terms of communal festivity. But certainly, if you're Muslims, if your neighbors are Muslims and they slaughter an animal for Eid, you'd partake in it, but you certainly wouldn't go to the mosque if you're Hindu. And vice versa, if you're Muslim living in the West Indies and your neighbors are sharing sweets for Diwali, you may well accept and partake in it, yet you wouldn't necessarily go to the temple type thing. So there's a lot happening in the West Indies that I think helps your case, and there's a lot that really is a very, very different sort of sociocultural texture. But nevertheless, it's certainly fascinating that you're weaving this as well into the case of the contribution of individuals of Indian descent, India, broadly South Asia, Indian civilization, India, I mean, not national India, citizens of Indian descent, contributing towards, I think what you're saying more or less is Dharma traditions on this landmass known as the New World. Let's dive into the next two chapters that are, I think, more to the point of focusing on the contribution towards modern American society, and also fascinating in and of themselves, because these are also two very different worlds. So one could, chapter two could be a book on the road. Chapter three could be a book. It's fascinating. In chapter three, you're talking about Indians and Ayurveda in America.
Before that, I would like to also add to the fact that how the whole civil rights movement, before doctors started coming into America or before IT professionals started coming into America, like my own case again, even before that, India or Indian ideas or Indic ideas such as nonviolence, I think, contributed significantly. For example, in the civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King and many of his colleagues and other African-American leaders actually visited India. They saw the residence of Mahatma Gandhi. They stayed for a number of days or even number of weeks in Maharashtra and other parts of India to really experience non-violence and other civil disobedience ideas that Gandhi and his colleagues practiced in India. And then they came back as African-American leaders visited India and came back to America. Then they incorporated those ideas into their own civil rights movement. So that's another feature of, you know, in terms of making of America, I think, you know, that itself, I think, is another idea for another book that can be really expanded on how those things happened and how this intermixing of ideas took place. Even though Gandhi himself, as we know, took that idea of civil disobedience from H.D. Thoreau, but then H.D. Thoreau in turn took some of the ideas from Bhagavad Gita and other, other Indic philosophical texts. So these ideas have been traveling for centuries from India to United States, back to India, and from Gandhi back to the United States. So that's another fascinating connection that India and the United States have long, even, you know, starting from Columbus, of course, but even later, yes.
Certainly, and I was hoping to talk a little bit about that towards the end of the interview, and I was going to ask you about the title Dharma in America. So maybe this is a good point, since you've already brought up some of these issues. What is this Dharma term? What do you mean by that, Dharma in America?
Yeah, so like I alluded, so Dharma in the sense of the ideas such as nonviolence, vegetarianism, Ayurveda, you know, some of the healthcare ideas, some of the dharma is the way I use in this book is not just, of course, not just religious ideas, but also civilizational ideas, cultural ideas, ideas that connect, that penetrate into even music. So many of the musical traditions that were really popular in 60s and 70s, when Ravi Shankar and Zakir Hussain and his father Allah Rakha were very, like, all, they were huge celebrities. Hard to imagine now, you know, Indian classical musicians being so popular in mainstream America. Like, there is a book on yoga from counterculture to pop culture. Similarly, there was a similar, you know, case can be made for Indian music, Indian classical music. So it was not just counterculture, but it was part of the pop culture back in 60s and 70s, not anymore. But so those ideas of dharma, I think even musical traditions, I connect with dharma, because many of the ways Ravi Shankar played, for example, on stage, he would make sure that Indian music has this undertone or even overtone of some of the dharmic ideas, spirituality, you know, chanting and, you know, spiritual chantings, and then that it is supposed to calm down one's whole being as he was playing his sitar, as he used to play his sitar. And so, and similarly, food ideas and Ayurveda, you know, it's all not just about physical well-being, but also mental and spiritual well-being, yoga and meditation. All of those are part of these, broader term dharma that I employ in this book. And then many times as we talk about these ideas, some of us, at least I do sometimes, is that I tend to equate dharma only with Hinduism, but we have to remember that Jainism has also been, long time, right when Swami Vivekanand, first Hindu to have come to North America, right with him, there was a Jain speaker, Jain scholar, lay scholar, who came with Swami Vivekanand, Veer Chand Gandhi. So Jainism has almost same history, you know, same span of history of existing in this country. So dharma is also, and Jains also use this term dharma. Of course, Buddhism also uses this term. So that's pretty widely known, but also, so history of Jainism also I bring into this path of dharma that I employ that term for all the chapters of this book. So
I think we'll revisit this idea of this broader notion of dharma as you define it. We'll revisit that idea towards the end of the interview. But let's maybe first focus on your findings with the American medical community, and we'll talk about that for a bit, and then we'll move on and touch on the Indian classical music and your findings there. So tell us about Ayurveda and medicine in Indians in North America. What were you surprised to discover?
Oh, yeah, many things. That's a good question. There are always pleasant surprises and maybe some unpleasant surprises also, but surprises nevertheless. So especially now that we are in the middle of this pandemic, and you know, almost every day on CNN, especially, you know, for example, we see Sanjay Gupta, we see Vivek Murthy also, for example, on Trevor Noah's show. And so some of the Indian doctors have, you know, become face of popular American medical mainstream media. But in addition to those, and of course, Deepak Chopra has almost become like a celebrity who is mentioned by American presidents when they visit India. So some of these doctors have taken, you know, captured the attention of mainstream American media. But in addition to these big celebrity doctors and leaders, but there have been also thousands and thousands of doctors that have been part of American medical system for now decades. We cannot use centuries here, but at least definitely decades. And so I was, I guess, unpleasantly surprised to find out that just as the early indentured laborers came to Caribbean countries and they faced all kinds of, you know, discrimination, persecution, and whatnot. You know, many of them died on the ships, as I'm sure you know, based on your diaspora studies expertise. That similar issues were also faced by doctors when they started coming to America, United States, specifically. They were targeted with all kinds of discrimination. They would be given lowly clerical kind of jobs. They would be forced to, you know, work in not so friendly conditions. They will be forced to remain in some, you know, cheap rural kind of locations that were not preferred by white Americans. And so how they survived, early doctors, how they fought for equality, even a term such as foreign doctor was very problematic for these early doctors, because foreign doctor makes them remain foreigner forever. So they fought, some of the Indian doctors, they went to Senate hearings and they made sure that a term like foreign is replaced at least by international. That even that was a big deal for them, because international was accepted as a bit more respectable term other than foreign. Foreign means exotic. So how they fought for that, how they created their own little organization with six or seven doctors to begin with in somewhere in Michigan, I think Detroit, and how they expanded. And today, Indian American Doctors is the largest ethnic association in North America, where they organize this community of doctors across the continent, how they do a lot of philanthropic work here, of course here, but also in India, how they work with United States government, Indian government, and, you know, keep raising such issues to do with equality, but also philanthropic activities and so on. So that was all really pleasant. Some of the pleasant surprises also, that how they have been now, I think, moved away from the early issues of discrimination. Now, I think Indian doctors, or even South Asian doctors, to, you know, use a broader term, I think are treated with much more respect and acceptability. Yesterday, I was watching, you know, one of the TV shows, you know, again, news shows. We're all locked down in our houses in this pandemic, so news have become more integral part of our life. And I was watching one of the shows and how one of the South Asian doctors was interviewed by a mainstream news show, and how the doctor was credited with saving life of a lawmaker in Michigan. So that shows that, you know, Indian doctors have, I think, done a great job in serving the mainstream American communities, and even in this pandemic, you know, Indian doctors and all the doctors, and but also Indian doctors as part of the larger medical community, have been at the forefront of fighting this medical war.
You know what? You better continue that thought. I'll hold my question, please. Okay.
Yes, that's the early part of that chapter, where I start with this history of how Indian doctors have contributed in making of America. And then I move to from Indian doctors to Indian medical ideas. So the history of Ayurveda I trace, And again, that's, you know, same struggle there in the initial part. Ayurveda actually continues its struggle even today. Even today, it's not treated with on equal terms with allopathy, for example. Ayurveda is still, you know, relegated to this category of complementary and alternative medicine. I discovered on some of the websites of Washington, D.C., federal government, National Institute of Health, NIH, where Ayurveda is still painted in very negative terms, as if it's some kind of, you know, selling snake oil or whatnot. So the struggle still continues. But I guess similar to what Indian doctors did, or similar struggles in Caribbean countries, Ayurveda practitioners have also did the same thing. They have formed their own organization, which now runs into hundreds and hundreds. I think 700 or 800. Ayurveda practitioners are part of this national association called National Ayurvedic Medical Association, NAMA, and many, many others now have come upon in this country, Association of Ayurvedic Professionals of North America, and many more. So they are creating their own accreditation system, their own ways of certifying their practices by kind of peer review, rigorous peer review, and they help support each other. There have been some monographs and edited volumes as well on these issues, on issues of Ayurveda and acceptance and issues of equality and so on. So that I trace. And then for the first time, I think I could present a detailed interview with one of the leading pioneers of bringing Ayurveda to this country, Dr. Vasant Lad. He lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I actually went to meet him. I stayed with, in Albuquerque for a few days, and I interviewed him, and I present that entire interview, I think for the first time, as part of a diaspora studies book in our field. So I was very happy to get that interview. Then also, speaking of my surprises, I'm losing my voice here. I also pleasantly surprised to see that, in the middle of Dallas, there are now over a dozen Ayurveda clinics. And even the suburb where I live in Dallas, there are now already two Ayurveda clinics where Indian-American Ayurveda practitioners have been offering these Ayurveda services for a long time here. And they are extremely popular. They are really flourishing here. And so ideas such as massage that comes from Ayurveda many other solutions that Ayurveda offers are really accepted by mainstream Americans, which is, I think, heartening to know that people are now more open in trying these alternative therapies, alternative ideas to keep improving their physical, mental, and spiritual health. So let's again see this trend of early struggle and then kind of counterculture. I think still it's Ayurveda is still part of the counterculture. It's not yet pop culture, whereas yoga has now become part of the pop culture, not just a counterculture, not just hidden feature, but Ayurveda still remains a counterculture. It's not yet very part of the main pop culture, but I think it's getting there. It's getting there and becoming more and more popular.
I have a question for you. Maybe this is a good time to ask it. Do you feel that the tension surrounding the, as you say, acceptance, quote unquote, of Ayurveda, do you feel the tension, is it the tension of Eurocentric paradigms versus Indic paradigms that I think is key to your book, or is it the tension between empirical paradigms versus more subtle or spiritual or holistic paradigms? So otherwise put, would not the same and this is a question for you, right? Would not the same tension apply to Western more holistic, for example, naturopathic medicine? There's a College of Naturopathic Medicine in Toronto. I've known people who've gone through it, and they're fine physicians. Can one not make the argument that, that naturopathic medicine is an analog to Ayurveda for the reasons of empiricism and not the reasons of cultural centrism?
Yeah, I think those are all really good points, Raj. and I think part of the resistance in accepting Ayurveda is stemming from both. I think treating anything that is coming from the Eastern Hemisphere, treating that as an exotic thing, and also this fear of not losing the empirical paradigm and remaining stuck with this dichotomy of body and mind, which is part of the empirical paradigm, I think is part of the problem also. And not seeing the wholeness in different parts, but, you know, making sure that everything remains dichotomous, separate, disjoint. That's how it, all these wars are derived. You know, war on climate change is separate from war on drugs. War on pandemic is separate from war on equality. This part of the world, I think, we lose that holistic perspective that is so much needed, I think, these days of climate change and pandemic and social inequality and racial inequality and whatnot. So I think slowly but surely, I think we'll get there when we, even in this part of the world, we will see everything as a holistic, in a holistic light rather than, you know, keeping them separate, I think. Right?
Do you think, in your opinion, based on your research, particularly your interviews with notable practitioners like Dr. Ladd and his student, Wynn Werner, do you believe that Ayurveda can be fully, properly, robustly practiced in the West, in America? Or do you think there are limitations?
Great point also, and one that I think every Ayurveda practitioner, I think, is thinking and wondering whether that day will ever come. I think some...
We'll draw on Wynn Werner's, your interview with Wynn Werner.
Yes. So yeah, Wynn Werner is actually a colleague of Dr. Ladd. He is kind of a manager or administrator of this Ayurveda Institute that they have been running for now a couple of decades in Albuquerque. And I think what I recall now is that they say that some parts of the Ayurveda, I think, can be much easier to be integrated in the mainstream American medical practices. For example, ideas that overlap with chiropractor kind of practices, massaging, and so various kinds of oil massages and so on are much more easily available and can be practiced without any liability issues. But some parts where Ayurveda uses some kind of medicines that are, I think, still not yet fully tested in America. So they no longer practice those practices or those medicines. They cannot prescribe in America because of less testing so far. So those are the challenges. Those are the bottlenecks.
So, can you hear me?
Yes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. bookstore.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, there was a thread in Wynne Warner's interview about the extent to which one can't parse out how much of Dr. Ladd's training is through his schooling and experience, and how much when he diagnoses somebody, and for those of you listening, Ayurveda, ancient Indian holistic medicine, as much an art as it is a science, it seems to be the case, relies upon pulse diagnosis, where a vaidya, a physician, an Ayurvedic physician, will take your pulse and then glean all kinds of insights about your health or lack thereof. I found this fascinating, where Werner is saying, well, initially we failed to parse out, and I'm paraphrasing obviously, we failed to parse out the extent to which one can learn to do that oneself, and the extent to which, according to Werner, one's insights are a function of one's advanced spiritual ability because of years and decades of practice. Do you see the sort of tension that I'm driving at here?
Yes. So as part of my research, while I was writing that chapter, a documentary was released based on life and contributions and practices by Dr. Vasant Ladd, one of the pioneers of Ayurveda in this country. In that documentary, I was really fascinated to find out that he still practices Ayurveda, even in this country, in a very traditional way, you know, without doing much fanfare and without, you know, going to media, but still sticking to the roots of Ayurveda and making sure to bring in many, many spiritual practices as he diagnoses his patients. So even in America and in India, he shuttles between Pune and Albuquerque, Maharashtra and New Mexico, and in which he is not just doing, you know, usual diagnosis that many other doctors do. He also is treating, you know, looking at a patient in a very spiritual or a very holistic way, you know, just to, in a very, what should we say, in a subconscious way, he diagnoses his patients, not just empirical ways. And that's what I think that his colleague Wynne Warner makes sure to highlight, that Ayurveda is not just empirical or tangible ways of diagnosis or prognosis of a patient, but it goes well beyond that. It's about you know, checking, just touching a patient's hand and checking his or her pulse and trying to figure out his entire spiritual well-being, his mental, psychological well-being, just by noting the pulse. So that's a very interesting and I think very interesting and very traditional way of how Ayurveda has been practiced for thousands of years in India. And so it's interesting that he, Dr. Ladd, is ensuring that is that skill, that ability, that pulse reading, for example, is really transferred to the next generation of Ayurveda practitioners. And he has empowered many of his students to learn those techniques and making sure that many American Ayurvedic practitioners are also doing those things now, which is not just, so it's not just, you know, stuck in India, but even in American Ayurveda, those things are being practiced. So, which of course raises interesting questions coming to empirical paradigm, that, you know, how far they can be accepted, how far they can be relied, but as far as the patients are happy and satisfied with these Ayurvedic practices, and it helps them, I think it'll take some more time, but they are still sticking to keeping it as traditional as possible, even in the United States, except the fact that those medicines, such as, you know, some amount of mercury or lead, should not be used at all in this part in America because of the liability issues, even though in some medicines, some of those elements were used in traditional Ayurveda in India. Those things are now left out. That's the tightrope that they walk on as they bring out the
work. So that's obviously a fascinating foyer, perhaps, into a subsequent study. Let's change gears a little bit and touch on music. Tell me about this idea of Indian ethnomusicology.
Yes, that word itself, you know, raises some questions, as you know, that in this part of the world, everything that is, you know, coming from the East or from Africa or Asia is always ethno, right? So there's a music department, there is a school of music, but I think 99% of all music departments, colleges in this country teach, or even K-12 schools, they teach only Western music, you know, music that has roots in European traditions. Even though some of the musical, for example, I was alluding to earlier, we were discussing earlier, Ravi Shankar and Zakir Hussain, they were part of the mainstream pop culture musical industry in this part of the world. But they are not part of the mainstream musical education in this part of the world. So K-12 music, for example, there's music, required music course in many, almost all schools in K-12 in America. But even ethno music is not introduced as part of the musical education. And same thing with colleges and universities. There is music, school of music, but then there would be, I think out of 100 schools, 100 universities, there might be one university where some parts of Asian music or African music will be taught, but it will be called as ethnomusicology. That's what has happened to Indian music also, even with all the efforts that Ravi Shankar and Zakir Hussain put in for decades. But so that's the, I guess, brief history of ethnomusicology.
And so then, just to give us a sense, I should say, those who are collectively will be listening to this, just to give us a sense, if you could wave a wand, what do you hope would be the case? Do you feel that music from a variety of cultures be taught in sort of public school, or like what is it that you wish would be otherwise?
Yeah, I think I would love to see that. Just like I think some schools in K-12 schools, for example, some form of yoga or meditation have been introduced successfully. In some parts, not so successfully. Even keeping them as secular as possible, but I think as long as students are exposed to different ideas, that music is not just what comes from European countries, but music is, you know, widespread phenomenon across the world. I think at least some kind of world music should be introduced to schools, in schools, you know, early in, even in K-12 curricula, and that's what has not yet happened to the best of my knowledge. So in this chapter, then we are talking about making of America or contributions to America. So in terms of music, then I trace the history of Ravi Shankar, his older brother, and Zakir Hussain, the tabla maestro, and his father, and how they collaborated with several celebrity musicians such as Yehudi Menuhin and many others, and how they influenced the jazz scene and you know, pop culture, counterculture, starting from counterculture, but even pop culture, and how they became so popular. And so I trace all of that. Many musical institutions they established. Ali Akbar Khan, for example, the Sarod Maestro, established this school of music in California that is still running successfully and that still trains many Americans to learn Indian music, Indian classical music we're talking about. But like Ayurveda, Indian classical music has also so far remained a very, you know, marginalized musical practice in America. Not many people know that there can be a successful career of becoming a professor of Indian classical music at some of the universities. We see very, very less number of such professors even, or scholars of Indian musical traditions. To counter that marginalization, what musical listeners and musical practitioners have done is, like in Ayurveda's case, they have formed their own association. So every metroplex, such as Dallas or New York or California, wherever big cities, wherever there are enough people of South Asian Indian heritage, they have formed these association and organizations, and they invite musical maestros from India periodically. And so as they come here and they perform, so, you know, parts of Indian classical music remains popular, at least in those niche areas and niche groups. So that's a healthy sign that, but I think Indian classical music has a even more difficulty for acceptance, even more than Ayurveda, because of, I think, dominance of Bollywood kind of music or popular music, as we might call it, that remains more dominant even in among Indians of in India and Indians who come here. So those are the challenges with Indian classical music.
It seems there is a parallel, an analog between, how do I phrase this? So when you're looking at Ayurveda, There is the tension that you were talking about in your book in terms of the presence of Indian thought, culture, people in the West. And then there is this other tension that is more universal between mainstream accepted scientific rational. I'm just obviously creating crude tropes for the sake of argument, versus the sort of marginalized, holistic, less charted paradigms. And it seems that with Indian classical music, again, you may well have the tension of, the cultural tension, but also there's a tension of classical versus popular, right? And so there's that piece as well.
Yes.
I'm going to move on in a moment to your chapter on Jains in America, but what do you hope to accomplish in your discussion of Indian classical music in America? What is it that you are trying to show?
A similar thought there, Raj, that, I mentioned that, students who are growing up in this globalized and pluralized world of today should not remain so unidimensional that they think that only this way of medical practice is the only or right way. Or this kind of musical, for example, I'll give you one more, I guess, specific example. My son takes the percussion lessons, and he will probably finish his entire K-12 education practicing only one form of percussion without even hearing the word tabla or pakhavaj or mridang. You know, amazing percussion instruments that come from South Asian heritage, all the way from Islamic heritage in India. And that is the, you know, of course, I will make sure that he will listen to those words, or I will even show him some of those performances by maybe Zakir Hussain or Alaraka. But imagine the, you know, kind of education that we are giving to our students, even in today's 21st century, when maybe 60% of students in my own public school here are of Asian heritage. And yet the school teachers, our school curricula, have no clue of broadening their curricula or, you know, incorporating diversity, you know, such a buzzword these days, diversity in equity and inclusion. When it comes to curricula, there is no, you know, not even a sign of bringing any diverse elements into musical education again, alluding to our previous chapter, diversity in medical education. Still, those foreign elements are treated with so much skepticism, and, you know, they're exoticized, marginalized, and so on. So those, I think, it's an ongoing struggle. And
I'm going to revisit this theme towards the end of our interview about practical steps forwards. Because I have some, one can make an argument from multiple perspectives about the nature, about how to remedy this issue or the extent to which this is even an issue that you raise. But hold that thought. Let's just finish with the data of the book before we get too expensive in our exchange. So then chapter five, I mean, it's the book is fascinating for a number of reasons. One is that, a musicologist would be super fascinated in a certain chapter, or somebody interested in Ayurveda or medicine would be super fascinated in a certain chapter. Historians, sociologists, there's tons of folks who probably would delight to see the charting on the Jain diaspora you do in chapter five. So talk about that, but preface your discussion with just a little bit of a context or a sense of, I had the good fortune of, first of all, I study religions, but I had the good fortune of going to India on a fellowship from the international, sorry, my brain's a little foggy, I haven't slept much last night, the international the International School of Jain Studies. Yeah. And I got to witness so much firsthand and learn from some great scholars of Jainism. But as you and I well know, what is Jainism, right? So talk a little bit about what Jainism is in terms of within the context of Indian religion, and then maybe you can unpack some of the data you present in chapter five.
Sure. So that's a really question with which is sort of we can talk for many hours. That what exactly is Hinduism or what exactly is Jainism, and how do
even just like the basic we teach in a very artificial formulaic way necessarily, but it's not without utility. So for example, when you're introducing Jainism in a world religion class, for example, like what is Jainism compared to Indian religion?
I guess to simplify also condense our time, Jain philosophy has been, as you know, is part of those so-called heterodox systems within Indian philosophy. So six are the orthodox, three are the heterodox, Astik and Nastik, right? So Jainism has denied the existence of creator and preserver and destroyer God, so-called quote-unquote God, for thousands of years. It's a non-theistic system, and yet it is full of rituals and temples and chantings and bhajans and whatnot. So very interesting. So Jainism in that respect is very similar to Buddhism, non-theistic. But then again, in Buddhism also, we have all those rituals and temples and so on. So some parts of the Jain community really takes pride that Jainism has always been separate and distinct from Hinduism. But some other Jains in the same community call themselves very proudly and very comfortably that they are also Hindus. So there's this healthy tension within the community of Jains across the world. I guess I answered your question, or that tension or interplay with Hinduism?
Yeah, I think there's enough there for folks to sort of get a sense. The one thing I'd say that is crucial for the title of your book is that, really all of the major world religions of Indic origin, so Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, they employ this word called dharma. So dharma in America, which can be variously translated as righteousness, ethics, duty, purpose. So in talking about, dharma, in many ways, you're talking about a way of life that's predicated upon certain ethical precepts. And irrespective of what's happening now on the planet, certainly historically or at least ideologically, Jainism has taken these precepts to the nth degree in this discourse of, ahimsa in particular, but such as ahimsa, asteya, brahmacharya. So this idea that this tradition is very much quintessential to how we understand dharma, right? Coming out of India. And so So although it's a how many Janes are there in the world currently? Maybe you have a better number than I have.
I think that number would again be sort of fluid number, because you know, depends whom you ask. But I think in my estimation there must be at least 100,000 Jains in North America. And in India, I think in total, probably that number would be somewhere around 8 to 10 million in India. So overall in the world, at least 10 million Jains, I think, across the world. Mostly in India, of course, but also in Nepal, Thailand, Kenya, United Kingdom, that is England, Belgium, and North America. I could not say... So,
certainly relative to global numbers, certainly a minority religion.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and that really contextualizes, I think, how interesting it is to have this in-depth play-by-play of the sort of the diasporic texture of this tradition in America. So maybe now talk about what you sort of map out in this chapter.
Yeah, so, So, like you mentioned, so Jains and Jainism has been kind of a marginalized tradition or community, even in our own South Asian studies field. So in diaspora studies, for example, I could not find any article or any major chapter where history of Jains was traced from the beginning to the contemporary times, how Jains arrived, what issues they faced, how they flourished, and now they at least 100 temples across North America they've built, and some of them are really magnificent, huge temples that they've built. So as I was alluding in the beginning, we all, Swami Vivekananda's name is, pretty well known now across North America, and especially definitely in South Asian studies or diaspora studies. But name of Veerchand Gandhi is not so well known, I think, in academic circles in diaspora studies or South Asian studies. So Veerchand Gandhi had also come with Swami Vivekananda. Now, here itself is an interesting phenomenon that I can share probably, that Swami Vivekananda, even as a monk, even as a Hindu monk, could easily travel, fly, take a ship and come to the United States and go to Europe and, travel across the world. But Jain monks and nuns have such ultimate discipline or restrictions, one might call, depending on whom you ask, that Jain monks and nuns cannot travel or would not travel willingly on any vehicle. So when a Jain monk was invited to be part of the world first parliament of religion in Chicago in 1893, that Jain monk has to now select a lay person, lay Jain person, who can represent the Jain community in this first parliament of religion. So that's how Veerchand Gandhi was selected by a Jain monk, and Veerchand Gandhi comes with Vivekananda, and he also gives several lectures in Chicago. He's also interviewed by New York Times at that time. And that all I share in the beginning of that chapter. So that marks the arrival of Jainism and a lay Jain person to North America. And then as we discussed in the beginning a little bit, how this idea of nonviolence has been traveling all the way from Jainism and Buddhism and Hinduism also. Nonviolence is not just monopoly of Jainism or Jains, but also in Hinduism and Buddhism. But most remarkably, Mahatma Gandhi learned this idea of nonviolence from a Jain guru, Srimad Rajchandra, with whom he corresponded. He exchanged letters for a number of years, at least 6 years, while Gandhi was in South Africa and Jain guru was in Gujarat. And with that influence, with a strong influence of that Jain guru, Mahatma Gandhi adopts these principles of nonviolence, and that changes his entire life and becomes a pillar of the Indian freedom struggle, as we all know. And then Mahatma Gandhi indirectly is transferring that idea of nonviolence as part of the civil rights movement, as we discussed in the beginning of this interview, in this podcast. And how that idea of nonviolence, civil disobedience contributed in the making of definitely the civil rights movement. So that I trace in that part of this, in this chapter also. So Jainism and Jainism's idea of nonviolence through Mahatma Gandhi all the way to Dr. Martin Luther King in the making of America. And then I sort of trace year by year how some of the earlier Jains formed their own association, like many other diaspora groups, like we already saw in the case of music and doctors, how they formed their own association. Jains did the similar thing. So in early 80s, they formed their own organization. But this is pretty different from how Hindus have been doing in this part of the world. Hindus remain sort of divided within Hindu community in several different regional groups or caste groups or so on. But Jains did something that they had never done in India. They transcended all those subcastes and subgroups and regional groupings, and they formed a Pan-American Jain Association called JAINA, JAINA. And that remains a unique experiment by Jains only in North America, where Jains of all different groups and regions and languages and sects have all come together and have formed this one umbrella group called JAINA, JAINA. And that how it has continued to successfully hold its biannual conventions, how it keeps having these elections to replace its leadership, how even young Jains, those of in 20s or even students, how they form their own separate umbrella organization or a subgroup within this this umbrella organization. So all that history I trace, and some of the early examples of Jain leaders, how the first Jain temple in this country, that's kind of a pleasant surprise, first Jain temple in this country, in this part of the world, in this continent, was found at a casino in Las Vegas. And when the British Raj apparently sent a model of an Indian temple in some exhibition in that, I think it was early 19th century, and accidentally some Jains from California encountered this Jain temple at a casino. And immediately they did the fundraising and immediately bought the temple. And now it is established, ritually established, installed as part of the Jain Center of Southern California near Los Angeles. So that's, little anecdotal information that I gathered during my research. And also American Jains directly or indirectly influenced at least some Jain monks, at least a few, at least around half a dozen, I think, up to this point, who actually broke away from their vows of being a monk or nun. And they did travel, even though in the beginning I said that they do not travel, but around half a dozen Jain ascetics have now at least broken some part of their ascetic vows, and they have been coming to this country now for a number of years. And that was very welcome, heartily accepted by Jains in America. Even though Jains in India did not like that monks and nuns are breaking those vows. But here, North American Jains desperately needed that guidance, that counseling, that leadership, ascetic leadership that has been hallmark of Jains for centuries. So they really welcomed these ascetics coming to America, and how they took their blessings, and that further cemented this new association that they started back in the 80s. So that all that I trace in this chapter. And then some of the key achievements, accomplishments over decades, what all Jains have been doing. Again, many, many philanthropic activities, many, many new temples that have been built, and so on. Yeah.
So you basically, in this book, you try and chart the contribution of Hindu and Jain individuals and ideas, mm-hmm. music, medicine, right. and so forth.
Right.
So let's maybe bring this full circle, and you could maybe share a little bit about your own personal story that you share in the book. But what difference in the world do you hope this book will make, or what trends do you hope to see as part of this awareness?
So I think it's interesting or important to note that how some ideas, some people, some communities, even though they may have contributed in a significant way to improve our society, our world, in their own humble ways, right? But I think it's important to, as part of the team of researchers and scholars and students of different world cultures. I think our little contribution is to bring those marginalized communities and contributions to forefront, and to make sure that that nothing or no being should remain marginalized or become part of persecution or discrimination ever, because as our societies are becoming increasingly diverse, I think it's important to notice that everybody, every community makes some humble contribution in reshaping or improving whichever location that they choose as part of the global migration. And so more information or more information about their contributions are shared among our students. I think it's better for our global coexistence, right? It's better for our mutual understanding, and it's simply better to know our neighbors, so to speak. You know, who knows how many neighborhoods are already now populated by so many immigrants in this part of the world now, and yet I think if our students do not learn about their neighborhood cultures in their K-12 schools or in their colleges, I think that dream of social cohesion will remain a dream. Especially during the times of disasters and what is happening right now these days, I think those are the times when these values are really under strain. You know, crime, for example, criminal incidences in New York have really shot up in last few weeks as our law and order situation becomes hopefully not worse. It is the minority communities that potentially can be first wave of victims. And if we do not take, you know, if we do not do our part in making sure that all of us really respect and understand each other well through education and through these such efforts that we all make as part of our own research and publications. I hope I answered your question.
Well, that's certainly a noble idea and lofty goal. Tell us what next or currently are you working on?
Now after this book, I wanted to continue working on Jainism because as I noticed, I think it's still, even though there are many, many books now on Jainism, but when I search for modern Jainism, there is still not a single book that comes up. Even if you search for modern Hinduism, modern Christianity, modern Buddhism, even there are many, many books, but modern Jainism, not one. So I'm working on this new book on modern Jainism and some of the key issues, key leaders, and key figures that have shaped what we can probably call as modern Jainism in the last two centuries. That's my current project.
That sounds like another interesting, groundbreaking project. So we'll have to talk about that book in future then.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Well, I think we've taken up enough of your time for today. So thank you very much for the interview. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, we've been speaking with Dr. Pankaj Jain of the University of North Texas on his new book, Dharma in America. Until next time, stay safe and keep reading. Take care.
Thanks, Raj.